Hi there, we are James and Dan, two fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I got one here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
Introducing the Jasper Cacao Project, your gateway to spiritual enlightenment through the power of cacao. This is a wholesome beverage that not only nourishes your body but also uplifts your soul. Jasper Cacao is ethically sourced, fairly traded, organically grown and crafted with love to bring you a truly transformative experience. Cacao, known as food of the gods, has been revered for centuries for its spiritual and healing properties. The Jasper Cacao Project honours this ancient tradition by offering you the purest form of cacao, free from additives and preservatives. Indulge in the rich beverages and feel the positive energy flow through you, whether you are looking to enhance your meditation practice, nourish your body with goodness, or simply savour a moment of bliss. The Cacao Project is here to accompany you on your spiritual journey. With every kilo sold, Jasper Cacao donate funds to the UK charity Plant Your Future, enabling farmers to sustainably grow their crops in the most eco-friendly way. Check out my bio for a discount on your first purchase, where you will receive 15% exclusive affiliate discount. Expanding love with every sip. Well, hello, lovely witches and beautiful souls. You are listening to the Bell Witch Podcast with me, Swales, the friendly green witch. Witched in the 21st century. This is episode 31. Thank you for joining me again. Gosh, this week is packed out and the bank holiday weekend just meant I'm behind so much. It's amazing the difference a day makes when you're a busy mum with two jobs and a witch biz and a dragon and everything else. This one was meant to be a solitary witch episode, but it's just not going to happen. I just don't have enough time. Things are going AWOL and wild, but that's okay because good things are happening. Yes, they are. For my first camping of 2024, woo! Bell Witch tent is coming back out, my little bell tent Delilah, having a first run of this year. So I'm preparing for this weekend's retreat. I think this time last year I was quite sad and trying to find new direction. That's the camping where I did Reiki and it set me off on a whole new discovery of life plan. So that's exciting. But yeah, that's just eating up all my time, along with Reiki clients and my other job needing me to do some training and all that jazz. Therefore, this episode is another amazing moot loot with my good friend Richard Chu, or Chu as we know him. I met Chu through a mutual good friend of ours. Chu is a right good laugh and just happens to be a heathen. And so I invited Chu to come on to the Bell Witch Podcast to tell us all about heathenry and how he got into it, what it's all about, because I know nothing. And wow, didn't he come through for me? He was fantastic at being on the podcast as a guest, which really surprised me because in real life we're quite silly together. But he just seemed really professional and blew me away with all his insider knowledge and understanding, and he talks in depth about the ritual of making mead for ceremony and also a little bit about gods and goddesses, folklore tales with Thor and all that jazz. And it was a really good episode. I enjoyed it so much, and I definitely know he'll have to come back and tell us some Celtic mythology and some storytelling from all the gods and goddesses that he's into. And we don't mind back-to-back moot loots, do we? I mean, the last one was also brilliant. Sarita from Wax Spiritual in Colchester. What an amazing guest. You could tell she was definitely a podcaster. How weird was it that all that spooky stuff started to happen towards the end when she was talking about her past experiences as a child when she needed a glass of water? As she was telling me that story, the computer started to crackle and freeze, and I were freaking out going, oh gosh, have I missed you? Are you still there? Are you still there? Luckily, because Zencast is such an amazing tool, it kept recording her end, so you just hear me sounding weird going like, are you still there? And she had no idea. But then it happened to Sarita the other way when she talks a bit more, and then she goes, oh, are you still there? It's like, oh no, the ghosts are playing with the internet. Just so weird. All evening, and it was a long recording, I think it was an hour and a half, it was absolutely fine up until we started talking about spooky stuff. That just intrigues me so much. Isn't it uncanny? All the topics we spoke about, it was spirit that decided to play about, or was it? Was it just coincidence? I don't believe in coincidences. I know you know my stand, but then I'm also can be a bit of a skeptic witch. If you haven't heard it, please do listen after this. Give her a follow as well on Wax Spiritual, and I do hope you can vote for Wax Spiritual in Business Colchester Awards. I really want her to win. I really want her to win. It'd be so fantastic. P.S. The video of that interview is actually on my Patreon, and you can join that for as little as £1.50, just a month. I'm still riding high on life, rereading The Secret, thanks to Matt and the Canny Crystal podcast. All the positivity is just seeping into my bones. Got The Secret and The Power, all the positive abundance manifested and power of attraction stuff. And I'm just flying through it. I have actually read it once already, but it didn't quite get to me as much as it's getting to me now. So I think it's all about the divine timings, the new moon being around, which is like new beginnings, isn't it? And power up in stuff. So that's fantastic timing for me. And I'm so full of gratitude. I do just go through my life being grateful. And I notice these little tests that are coming to me. I feel like the universe is testing me quite a lot. A good example of this is I had a very expensive goth coat from 2000s that I got to resell in pristine condition. A beautiful man's jacket with big lapels, beautiful cuffs and big buttons. It's probably worth about £120 to £150. I had it on my Depop and my vinted for quite some time, and it was hung on the back of the door, and the gerbils had managed to grab hold of this coat, pull it in and nibble it, so they've made a very unsightly hole in the back of it. And when my little girl told me, she was expecting me to just fly through the roof and I had a brief second of going like, you what? But then I just breathed and tried not to respond angrily. Calmly said, oh well, I didn't pay much for it. I'll either give it away or try and get somebody to fix it. But even if I get it fixed, it's probably only going to be worth £50 now. So I probably won't bother. I'll just hand it down to somebody who may be able to fix it, which is such a shame. It is such a shame. But these things happen and I'm not out of pocket. I did all right finding it and I've had it a good year, so maybe it's just time to let it go. Maybe I held on to it too long. I'm having loads of things testing me and I'm trying not to react so quickly to them. That's half the battle for me, really. Road rage is really hard not to react to. But in terms of manifesting, bad things happen and you keep hold of it, like the puddle from a few episodes ago, or you can thank the universe for the education and let it go. And I read from The Secret that thank you, the term thank you, is probably one of the most powerfulest terms you can send out, because the vibration of thank you that is really felt, humble and real, is the most powerful vibration that attracts. So, you know, as soon as you wake up, be thankful that you've woken up. Say thank you for that amazing sleep. Put your feet on the floor. As you put one foot, thank the other foot, you. And it's a really handy way just to remind yourself to start on a positive. And that will ensure that the whole day will be positive for you and go your way. Yeah, it's not easy, but it's just practice. It is practice. It can be doable. I used to be such a negative person. A few years back, I was horrendously negative. I think it'd make a good episode from a witch's perspective, perhaps, on the laws of attraction and magic, because it kind of works really well with sympathetic magic. Pretty sure there's a couple of episodes in there as a solitary witch episodes. Is this something you are interested in? If it is, please slide into my DMs or message me on thebellwitchpodcast@yahoo.com. I'd like a bit of input as to actually what you'd like me to cover. That would be so helpful if you could give me a bit of interaction, please. Thank you. Follow me whenever you listen. Try rate me wherever you listen. Tell everybody how awesome it is. And now I'm a right nice witch. And yeah, I'll press play, enjoy, and see you on the other side, witches. Welcome to the Bell Witch Podcast. Happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Good Modendag, one and all.
Oh, posh.
That's a little heave and greeting from me to you.
So, Chu's come on to the Bell Witch Podcast to tell us all about being a druid, is it?
Even.
A heathen. I don't know why I keep saying druid. I always just have that in my head. Chu is a good friend of mine, and we hang out and do lots of silliness when we go drinking and stuff and have a right good time. So this one, it'll be a good engaging experience.
Let's try to keep the podcast unbiased, shall we? But yeah, I am in fact known as a heathen or a Germanic pagan. There's a lot of different misconceptions about my little branch of paganism. So what essentially is sort of a reconstructed belief system of what kind of took place during pre-Christian Europe. And a lot of our faith kind of relies heavily on existing like archaeological and historical evidence. As I say, it's quite a polytheistic worldview. You know, we honor a pantheon of deities. A lot of times it gets confused with Norse paganism, the Scandinavian role of gods, you know, Thor, Odin. But what I identify more is as a Germanic pagan, which not only encompasses the Scandinavian side of it, but also the Anglo-Saxon, the English side, sort of Western Germanicism as well. Obviously, because I live in the country, for one. But the problem with sort of the Anglo-Saxon side of Germanic paganism is there's a lot less surviving historical texts. So I sort of use the ones in Scandinavia as sort of like the backbone of my faith. It's kind of funny how it all started. My mother is pagan, so it kind of makes me second generation pagan, if you will. And for years and years, I kind of toyed with the idea of becoming a Wiccan myself. Like from my earliest days as a child, I was kind of brought into this kind of world, you know, the sort of spiritual, paranormal, supernatural world. And I just remember my mother had a room in the house and it was just full of crystals and runes and more books to fill out a library. It was just so much incredible stuff. And I remember just looking at it thinking, wow, what is all this stuff? You know, it looks so goddamn cool. So my interest kind of peaked like from there. And as I got older, I started taking more information. I started to read more. I started to read up on the occult, esotericism, stuff like that. But it wasn't until I got to around my 30s that I actually committed, I actually made a move to the path. But the funny thing is, heathenry just kind of came out of nowhere. I toyed with the idea of becoming a Wiccan for so long, but it wasn't until I met my friend Luke at my current job where this opportunity came from. He told me that he met a friend through going out in nature and doing bushcraft together, which is sort of the art of creating things out of the Earth's natural resources. You know, building shelters, building tools. And that's another thing that our faith relies quite heavily on, living a lifestyle more akin to our forebears, our ancestors, back when men learned practical skills, sort of cooking and hunting, foraging, providing, because that was pretty much the backbone hundreds and hundreds of years ago. It was sort of an art of survival, if you know what I mean. So he told me that they'd done the bushcraft together, but he introduced him to what's known as heathenry, Germanic paganism. And to me at the time, it was pretty alien. I'd never even heard of it. So I was like, oh, yeah, okay. I was interested. So he says, would you like to come and meet him? So I said, yes, I'd love to. And I met him for the first time. This was the first kindred that I was a part of. I know Wiccans, they meet up in, you know, covens. But in heathenry, we go by kindreds or hearths. That's our collective, you know, group. And from meeting him for the first time, he welcomed me in. And we sort of did our first blot. Now, a blot is, it's an old Norse term, and it essentially means sacrifice. I know that sounds and stuff like that, but I'd just like to assure you, you know, no children or animals were harmed during our so-called blots. all it is, it's an old Nordic word for blot, but we only honoured our deities using like food offerings and alcohol, mead, essentially. I know you got your mead, by the way.
I did. I hadn't drank it yet. I was meaning to, and I kind of want it to be a special occasion drink because, I mean, you made it with magic. Might be a bit early for me, yeah. If we make it till 12, I might open it.
It's never too early for mead. But yeah, so it was an initiation rite at the time, but it was my first introduction into heathenry. And we went out into my friend's garden. He had a sacred space, an altar set up, which we also call a weirford, which is an old Anglo-Saxon term. And, you know, he had the table set up, the altar cloth. We had all the hand-carved wooden idols. We had the ceremonial hammer, which we use to open and close the actual blots themselves. And I just remember just so blown away by the initial experience of it all. We recited some written prose. We made a toast to Odin, Allfather, which is, you know, the Zeus of the Nordic world. He's like the head figure, the patron god. And we then proceeded onto an act known as Simbel, which is a ceremonial passing of a horn of alcohol, traditionally mead. So We pass the horn around and we each take a sip and we honor the gods and then make a toast to them using the traditional Nordic word, skull. Anybody who's watched Vikings or Game of Thrones will kind of know what that means. And from that moment on, he says, you can come back anytime. I want you to reflect, I want you to think about, you know, what we've just done today. And I remember I was so, I couldn't even describe it. I got home that day and it's almost as if something just took over me. The first thing I did when I got home was I decided to build my own sacred space in my home. So, and I already had an idea of it in my head. First thing I wanted to do is get like a table, a nice antique, like curved leg table. I don't know why, but that was in my head that I wanted. And I was fortunate enough to find one in an old charity shop, the British Art Foundation. So I saw it and bought it. I can't remember how much it cost, but I just knew it was perfect. Took it home, put it in the center of my living room. I put an altar cloth over it and started to build from there. But that was the beginning that marked my path as a heathen Germanic pagan. From then on, I attended more blots. We went out in nature, and soon enough, my dedication was recognized, and I was then promoted to a council member position, a council freeman. In honor of the new title, I was given an offering, a dragon offering, which I still have to this day. And I was given a ceremonial blade, which we call a sax blade, spelled S-E-A-X, a handcrafted blade, which was granted to me as title of freeman. And it's still there on my altar to this day. Unfortunately, though, I have parted ways with the kindred itself. It came to a point where I realized that this particular group wasn't right for me. There's a sort of a stigma in heathenry and Norse paganism where some unsavory individuals have used our particular branch of paganism as a platform for bigotry and intolerance. The view god figures such as Thor and Odin as these benevolent white masculine male figures. And unfortunately, it's more prevalent in the United States and Germany, where there's a term that we use called folkish evens, where they believe the faith should only be practiced by people of white skin, not necessarily Aryan, but it's something that we try to avoid at all costs, because unfortunately it is black mark in our particular kind of paganism. Because we're not about that. We're all about inclusive. We like to accept people and love people for the differences, for who they are. And unfortunately, that was the direction we was kind of going in. It sort of adopted the mindset of sort of the Odinists and the Wotanists in Germany. As soon as I noticed that's the direction we were veering into, I had to leave. And it was a really hard time for me as well, because I was sort of lost from that point on. I just became a solitary practitioner, and I just honored the gods in my own time, my own space. Sooner or later, my friend Luke also left as well due to the direction they were going in. But to me, it was just about a faith where we honor our ancestors, our heritage, go out into the woods, we honor our gods. So that was what it was all about for me. But now I've come across a new group of people. It's a kindred based in Leeds called the Iron Ravens, the Iron Raven Kindred. At the moment, I'm still an affiliate. I've attended a few gatherings, but I'm not officially a member yet. I understand that I have to earn, I have to earn the respect. You know, we had a gathering a couple of weeks ago, say about 20 people. I helped cater. With my friend Billy, we cooked a giant feast. My friend has converted his sort of outhouse shed garage into like a giant mead hall where we got two long tables. Me and my friend were prepping a feast for several hours. There was so much food, so much mead. And we all got together like a family. We all sat down, we feasted, we drank, toasted our gods. In between that, we were doing axe throwing and archery in my garden. It's not just, a collective group. It's a brotherhood. Everyone loves one another. We all respect one another. And it's something that I missed from my days of being in my last kindred. So my motivation now is to keep attending, and hopefully one day I'll become an honorary Iron Raven myself.
You have to build yourself up again. I mean, I think the first one was just the gateway to open it up to you, did its job, and then you go find something else. Because didn't it have connections with, like, Nazi Germany, and that's why it gets a bit dodgy?
obviously, with it being a Germanic faith, and obviously all Germanic countries originated from Germany, it's still extremely popular in Germany. But the thing is, with heathenry and Germanic paganism, it's sort of breaking off into little clusters of subcategories. It's almost like the heavy metal genre. There's subgenres, and it's crazy. It's like everybody just wants to create their own little version, and it becomes confusing. Mm-hmm. In Germany, you have Odinism and Wotanism. Wotan is obviously the German name for Odin. But some people have just decided to take that faith to use as a platform for hatred and intolerance. And that's just something that I don't respect. It has no place in my life. And some people will probably hear, they'll see the symbolism and they think, ooh, they'll see Thor's hammer, Mjolnir. They'll see the three-pointed triangle, the Valknut. They'll shudder, on the symbolism, but it's not what it should be about. Paganism to me was always about that connection with, the spiritual world, with gods, with your fellow man. It's actually took over massively in the United States, but it goes by the name of Asatru, which is another confusing little subgenre. The Scandinavian pantheon of gods is divided into two parts. They have the Asatru, or the Aesir, which is the gods that probably everybody has heard of, Odin, Thor, Tyr. But there's also the Vanir, the Vanatru, which is gods that probably people have lesser heard of, such as Freya, which is one of my patron goddesses, her brother Freyr, and Njord. But the Aesatru, they exclusively just honour the Aesir side of the pantheon. But it's creeping into the United Kingdom now, where there is a group known as Aesatru UK that is in place, and they do regular gatherings, or we call them moots, you know, which is, you know, a gathering of heathens. But I try not to get lost in all the little subgenres. To make it even more confusing, if you follow exclusively to the Anglo-Saxon side of it, they've got their own little groups as well. So they have Fern Sidhu and Theodism and things like that. So it can be quite a confusing branch, quite a complicated branch of paganism for people to get into. When you mention polytheism or paganism to people today, a lot of them instinctively think Wicca. I don't know if it's been exposed more, but there's other variations of paganism. There's, you know, Druidry, as you mentioned before, and a lot of it is based on geographical region as well. There's Hellenistic paganism, which focuses on the ancient, you know, Greek traditions. They had their own pantheon of gods. They had there's Roman paganism, which focuses on, you know, their own pantheon named after planets of the solar system. And then you go across the world, there's Celtic, there's Slavic, there's Mesoamerican. So it's quite a vast umbrella.
It's paganism. Massive. Yeah.
I'm trying to explain it to people at work, and they're just like, what? Another thing as well, it's, to me, paganism is not a religion. It's just the universal spiritual belief system that was in place prior to organized religion. My friend Luke doesn't even like the term pagan because he believes it was a derogatory term used by practicing polytheists dubbed to us by Christianity. So he doesn't like the term pagan, but for ease of understanding for everybody else, you know, I do go by the term pagan. A lot of our faith relies heavily on living to a lifestyle akin to our forebears, our ancestors. So whereas Wicca, you know, you focus heavily on witchcraft, ours is more learning the law and mastering the art of practical skills. As I said, my friend Luke is very well adept at bushcraft. Me, myself, it's more mead brewing, because mead is a, you know, it's an essential part of our faith. It's the sacramental drink that we use to honor our gods. But yeah, it's been a huge part of my life for many years now. I love it so much. And it's funny how I toyed with the ideas of being a Wiccan for so many times.
I remember you going through it,
and I had so many opportunities to do that. I got invited to groups, you know, and I don't know why, but I never took that step. But then this opportunity came out of nowhere. This whole new branch just came into my life, and I don't know, it took over me. It's like it just happened, and I never doubted it. I never questioned it. It was almost as this was the direction the universe was pushing me into. And yeah, I just went ahead with it, and I never questioned it.
Yeah, if you're open to it, it'll find you. You follow the breadcrumbs, don't you? And it takes you where you're meant to be.
I would say it was more like had the loaf thrown at me.
I just like knocked you out.
But yeah, that's sort of the generalistic background of being a heathen.
Do you do like magic and spells, or is that not really what it is?
We don't really practice it, no, but it is attested in our mythology. As I mentioned before, the Vanir, the Vanatru, were practitioners of magic. My patron goddess Freya, the maiden goddess, she is the goddess of beauty, sex, magic. And I'm sure there's books out there with, you know, to teach people magic, but from my experience, we've not actually practiced it. A lot of what we do is obviously learn from, you know, surviving texts, law, and, you know, learning practical based skills. That is sort of our niche, you know, to our faith. I also practice divination using my runes. I have a set of runestones made of lapis stone, lapis lazuli, which is one of my favorite stones. It's actually the stone of wisdom from Odin. This is his own personal stone, and they're carved with the Elder Fuvark runic system. The Fuvark is sort of a proto-Germanic alphabet. It goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. As I practice divination with them, I usually take a rune out at random, and I can do that at the start of the day, or I do that at the end of the day as to reflect if I've got a question in mind. I've also got a book where it teaches me how to do a 3-rune draw, a 5-rune draw, 7, 9. Using runes has helped me a lot in my life, and it has guided me. Doesn't give you all the answers, but it gives you a little nudge in the right direction, so to speak. And I've done rune draws for friends, you know, when they've needed help or they've needed advice. Also, I have tarot cards as well, but I focus exclusively on the runes. You know, I also have a hand-carved set as well, which I actually hand-carved myself out of an old oak tree, stained them, painted the actual runic symbols themselves. And you'll see runes everywhere, especially out in nature. Me and my friends have done walks. We've done little rambles out in the woods, and you can see them made out of branches, out of sticks, on the ground, and you can just see the natural runes. The more you work with them, the more you see them out in the world. And I think that's pretty cool.
Noticing, looking around and noticing the details and the messages as you walk around your life.
I think the more you kind of expose yourself into the world, the more you see.
Hello, I'm Michelle, the host of Haunted Moonlight. If you enjoy spooky things like hauntings, aliens, cryptids, witches, rituals, movies, books, listener tales, and so much more, then come take a listen to Haunted Moonlight. New episodes drop every Sunday and are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audible, and iHeartRadio. Can't wait to keep it spooky with you.
My friend Luke, who goes by the name Barefoot Wanderer, in our last kindred, we were sort of encouraged to have our own names, our own clan names. And my friend Luke's was the Barefoot Wanderer because he was sort of notorious for just walking everywhere with no shoes or socks on, because he liked the feeling of the natural earth under his feet. He liked the feel of the soil between his toes. He felt more enrooted to the ground. He felt a better connection of nature doing that. I actually go by the name, I've mentioned this to you before, the name Ulfheden, which is actually the singular term for the plural word, the word Ulfhednar, which were a group of wolven-raced warriors, as they're attested in the Poetic and Prose Edda, which is sort of like the Bible in heathenry, for lack of a better word. But it's our sacred text that we, that we follow as part of our faith. And the Ulfhednar were a wolven race of warriors, essentially berserkers, except they adorned a pelt of wolf hide rather than a bear. And they were known as Odin's kind of elite forces, if you know what I mean. Gone through quite a lot of battles in my own personal life, so I've kind of adopted the attitude, the mentality of a warrior, you know, to fight through obstacles and oppositions. It's really sort of to give my mindset, you know, that strength. And I also have quite a fascination with wolves. I know because I watched one of your episodes on your podcast.
Did you like it?
I did. As soon as I saw the word wolves, I clicked on it straight away. Really love the meditation ones as well.
Oh, thanks, love.
That's okay. I've been listening to them to chill out, relax on a night. But yeah, as I said, we're all encouraged to have a name that was meaningful to us. My friend likes to walk around barefoot, and I had an obsession with wolves. The wolf is my spirit animal. I've had dreams where wolf has been prominent in my dreams, and they're just symbolic of loyalty, kinship. They're very intelligent animals. Just from how they act, the behavior, there's a strict formation how they even travel in packs. They have the strong at the front and the back, and the older ones are actually kept in the middle as protection. That's how intelligent and fiercely loyal these animals are, where they actually travel in a certain formation to protect their elderly. And I just think that's a really beautiful thing.
But do you howl?
I've been known to howl.
The moon.
Especially after a couple of horns of good mead. Because you know mead's a very important thing to me. I started brewing mead. A lot of people don't really understand what mead is. It's sort of rising, you know, from the dead again, like a phoenix. Not a lot of people know that mead is actually the first alcoholic drink in history. It was sort of invented by accident. Its exact origins are still shrouded in mystery. But from my own research, archaeologists have dug up in China, I believe. They actually found a still with residual traces of fermented honey, which they believe some honey was left out in a still and it was forgotten about, essentially. And it wild fermented off its own natural sugar. As all the greatest things in the world happen by accident, all the greatest inventions, alcohol was born. It kind of got lost to time. It's had a resurgence recently because of TV shows like Vikings, Game of Thrones, The Last Kingdom. And then suddenly people are starting to wake up and see what mead is again. They're like, what's mead? You know, what is this stuff? And I've never even heard of it. You know, I know gin and tonic, you know, I know wine, but I don't know what mead is. And I was taught early on in my first kindred how to create a basic batch, which is three ingredients, yeast, honey, water. To make a simple batch, you melt the honey down into the water to create something called a must. And then as it's cooled, it's caught pitched into your vessel, your brewing container. Next step comes the yeast. And there's several ways you can go about it. You can wild ferment it off its own natural sugar, like I said before, or you can actually add an organic yeast to it. I love yeast as an ingredient because it's essentially a living organism. And as the yeast oxidizes and you see it working, and you know the natural process of converting sugar into alcohol begins, you can sort of see it like breathing. On the top, it moves, and it's like
like alive.
It is, and you've essentially created a living organism. But that's just the natural elements going to work. And my first batch was terrible. I admit, my first batch was absolutely horrendous. There's so much that you have to take into consideration when making not only mead but alcohol. You have to think about tannins, like natural tannins, things that you use to give alcohol body and structure. You have to think about stabilizing the product, because if you don't stabilize it, it reoxidizes and it keeps fermenting into stronger and harsher alcohol. And the first time I brewed a batch, I didn't know about it. So I bottled, you know, this bathtub concoction up and put these little cork tops on. And then I had them all in the base of my wardrobe. And in the middle of the night, I just heard this, and then another one. What's all these popping noises coming from? And then I'm looking in my wardrobe and I've got like an army of little mead bombs going off, like pop, 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 pop.
That's amazing.
And I'm like, oh God, what's happened? The stuff is just going haywire. And then base of my wardrobe is just getting flooded with mead. And I'm like, what the fuck have I done? I didn't know about stabilizing and things like that. So it's been a real trial and error process. And for the most part, I've actually been learning off my own back with the help of a few books. I've got some really good books at home that teach you various ways how to make mead, and not just mead, mead-infused ales like Braggart and things like that that I've yet to venture into. But I've been sort of experimenting with lots of crazy flavors at the moment. My most popular one is Viking's Blood, which is forest fruit mead.
Ooh.
Oh yeah, I get a lot of demands for this one. Raspberry, blackberry, blueberry, and cherry. Also done strawberry. I've done a vanilla chamomile win, which turned out to be one of the most challenging meads that I've made in terms of balancing flavour. My personal favourite is my autumnal harvest mead. It's brewed with an apple juice as a base instead of water, and I add the addition of more fresh apples, some ginger root, and some mixed spices. And it smells incredible. It smells like parking cake when it's brewing. I'm like a little witch on my cauldron. You know, I've got a big 25-litre cook pot, And I'm there just stirring this potion up, and you can smell all the, you know, the herbs and the spices. And that's probably the closest thing I've got to magic as part of my faith.
I was going to say, you did. I mean, you'll make it mindfully, won't you? And you'll be like putting good intention in it and stuff. Or do you not do that? Do you just make it?
No. I started to make it willy-nilly in the beginning, but this has come to like a process where I've sort of refined it over the years. It's almost become like an alchemy and a science, an art form all in itself. And each batch I've learned new tricks to like perfect the mead and, you know, revise what you use for tannins, revise, you know, what temperatures that I keep the containers at and things like that. And I've got to a point now where I think I make some pretty damn good mead. It's quite popular. I have a lot of friends who come and take bottles. I recently bottled about 40 500 ml bottles, and I've got about 8 left.
Oh, nice.
I took several to the gathering that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. And, God, these guys drink mead like it's Ribena. Honestly, I saw them all, watched them, they're great. Oh, my God, this stuff's amazing. Oh, this is the best mead I've ever had. And it does make you feel good. It makes you feel proud because, you know, I made that myself and I put a lot of love and a lot of heart into it. Because to me, it's not just making alcohol. It's something deeply personal to me because it's important to my own faith. And I think the gods appreciate, you know, using the good stuff. When you hold ceremony and you honor the gods, you don't just get the cheap knockoff stuff from Morrison's. You actually have personally put your own love and your own creativity into it. Yeah, that's mead, essentially.
All my listeners are going to want to purchase this mead.
Ooh.
How do they do that? Can they do that?
They can do that, but I need to get back to a point where I have a regular supply because I used to have rolling batches going every month. The problem with mead is it takes a long time. It's not essentially the actual making of it. It's the waiting around aging part of it. Because it's akin to wine. It's the closest thing to wine in terms of structure, how it is. You just substitute the grapes for honey. But a lot of it is the waiting around because you need to burn off all the ethanol, all that hot, nasty alcohol that's created after fermentation. It takes several months to age out.
And, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It does, yeah. In the beginning, it's I used to get my batches done in around 3 months minimum, making what's known as short meads. But now I've kind of give it 4 months now because I've noticed that extra 4 weeks really rounds out the edges. But if you leave a bottle out, and it will age like wine. I had a bottle of my Viking's blood that I left on my altar, and I forgot about it. Only a little residual amount, but I left it on there for about a good 11 to 12 months. And I'm like, oh, there's that mead. Oh, I wonder what that tastes like now. And it had gone from like your fresh, light, fruity, honey flavor. And I took one little smell of it and I'm like, ooh, that is dark. That is intense. And I took a sip and I'm like, whoa, it's like pot. It's like, it's got these like fruitcake flavors. It's got really intense and complicated as it's aged. And I'm thinking, maybe I should start aging them a little bit more just to see, you know, this is the fun that you have with it. You know, you play around, you experiment, and I'm going to keep a couple of bottles of my current batch around to see what it's going to be like in 12 months' time. But I need to get my batches back onto a regular monthly thing because a lot of the times they sell out too fast and then I'm waiting around for my next batch to age. So yeah, I've not even started my current batch yet. I'm currently planning to make a black cherry mead.
Ooh, nice.
But I'm still waiting on a few supplies. And obviously I got to acquire bottles. The labels I actually custom make myself. You know, you can see the little label. And this is another thing with my mead. Each bottle, each flavor has its own unique name and story behind it. It's a little fun, groovy concept that I came with. I was inspired by, you know, the Witchwood Brewery that make Hobgoblin. You see the artwork and then you read the information on the back. It's almost kind of whimsical, fantasy-like, and I liked the idea of it. So Each flavor that I made, I dedicated to a particular god or goddess, or a specific piece of Scandinavian Anglo-Saxon lore mythology. Like the autumn harvest mead, I actually honored to Freyr, which is the Norse god of the harvest. The twin brother of Freya, he's a god that's situated with the autumnal equinox. And as a hot autumn harvest blend, I made it to honor him specifically. My recent one, I honored to Odin, Allfather, because he's a god of many things, poetry, mead especially. And I went about it a little bit different this time. I actually used a really good oak honey to give it that woody cask notes, and you can really taste it in the brew. But the black cherry one, I'm still in the process. So I know a lot of people are listening thinking, oh, it sounds quite good, this. This guy seems to know what he's talking about. Maybe I should get some, but...
Yes.
I'm not going to have enough ready at this time because I need to get back up to doing it regularly like I did. A lot of it was due to money as well, because it's not cheap to make. I used the really good, raw, unpasteurized, natural honey. I don't like to use the, you know, the store-bought stuff. It's very pasteurized and refined, and you don't get all the good natural health benefits from, you know, from using the good quality honey. I tried to get the all-natural stuff, and it costs around 10 quid a kilo. Not cheap. But a lot of things that people don't know about me, there's a fantastic history with it. Druids actually brewed it as a form of like a pseudo-scientific remedy for warriors in battle, the health benefits of honey, because honey is very bioactive naturally, like a manuka, and they say, you know, have a spoonful of honey a day. It's great for your physical well-being, and it was brewed up with all sort of botanical plants and other ingredients, and it was sort of used as a remedy. In a way, you know, you can brew it up with stuff like ginger and citrus, and you've got the basis of a natural penicillin. You know, you've got your honey, your lemon, your ginger, and you'd use it to fight off all manner of ailments. Another exciting thing as well, do you know the term honeymoon actually comes from mead as well?
No.
Ah.
I love stuff like this.
Yeah, we're learning today. well, the story goes, years and years and years ago, kings would actually include in like the daughter's wedding dowry an entire month's supply, an entire moon cycle worth of mead as a gift to earn a husband. And that would sort of encourage sort of like a fruitful union to bear lots and lots of children. Because it was an entire 28-day cycle, it was known as honey moon, because it was a whole moon cycle, and obviously mead is made from honey, so that's where the term honeymoon comes from.
That's amazing. I love that. So good.
So if you want lots to make lots of babies, just...
get your mead, darn you.
I'm surprised I haven't got an entire army of them, the amount I've drunk over the years. I've only got one. Yeah, she's my little shield maiden, and I love her to bits. That's all I need.
Aww.
It'd be a dream of mine if my daughter followed down the pagan path. You know, I have a little third generation pagan on my hands. When I was a kid, my mum introduced me to this world, and, you know, she never forced it on me. She encouraged my interest, and she'd share a lot of things about the faith, and it'd be nice to introduce my daughter, see what she thinks.
Yeah, I'm in the same position really with my two. All you can do is offer it to them, and they might take it and they might not, and they probably won't take it straight away, and then later on down the line they'll get interested.
Well, my own personal opinion is stuff like religion and faith shouldn't be really indoctrinated. I'm kind of against sort of forcing it on people at a very young age, an age where people are not really capable of critical thinking. I wait for them to a mind to fully develop, and then they make their own choices from there. You can introduce it to them, you know, see how they react. But people want to follow a faith, it should be part of their own natural development. It should be their choice, and it shouldn't be forced upon.
Would you say, like, heathenry to me as an outsider looking in, it seems quite masculine compared to what I'm into, which is very, very feminine. I mean, it is balanced mostly mine, but the feminine is a little bit higher, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, and honestly, I've got no problem with that. And I don't think people should really look too far into sort of like the gender side of it. The Iron Raven kindred, as, you know, female members, open our doors to anybody, any age, sexual orientation. It is quite seen as quite a manly based thing. The old kind of like Viking, it's kind of nicknamed the Viking religion. And what do you think about Vikings? It's these big, burly, bearded,
big horns, like.
No. Misconception. A lot of people think that Vikings, Scandinavian warriors, wore horned helms. And it's actually not true, believe it or not. I don't know where the misconception came from. I've heard a lot of theories online. There was one where a French painter actually drew a portrait of a Norse warrior, and he featured horns. I don't know if they were goat or ram horns, but looking at archaeological evidence, I've been to the Jorvik Museum in York, and you can see all the actual findings, and there's no horns, there's no horned helmets everywhere. They actually just have just a round-shaped helm with probably a nose piece. But yeah, it's one of the biggest misconceptions about Vikings that they actually wore horns.
I thought actually it was because of, you know, that cartoon, is it Asterix?
Yeah. Well, he actually has wings. If you look at Asterix's helmet, it's actually wings.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Sort of little Pegasus wings.
Oh, so cute.
I know. I used to love the comics when I was a kid. I think I read all of them in high school. But yeah, as I was saying, there is quite a masculine vibe. You know, people look at Thor and he's a big, burly, masculine man. But there's another misconception. His depiction in the Marvel films, completely nothing to how he's attested in the Eddas. In the movies, he's this chiseled, blonde-haired, handsome-looking, you know, man. And he couldn't be any further from the truth. His actual real depiction, if you read up on his lore, is actually a very large, heavy-set man who eats and drinks a lot, and he's quite big. I'm not saying fat, but he's kind of got the body type of a strong man. And he has he's actually red-haired. Anyone who's played the God of War video games will know that is quite the accurate representation. He was sort of an alcoholic in a way. It's, there's a famous tale, it's the tale of Utgarda Loki, where the gods have a history with like the giants, the Jotun race. Now, in Norse mythology, there's a lot of tales about, you know, the gods versus the race of giants. It's quite prevalent in Greece mythology as well, the gods versus the titans. And in this particular tale, the god Thor gets issued with a set of challenges, and one of them is a drinking contest. But the giants, who are not a particular big fan of the gods, sort of play a bit of a prank on them. It does in all three challenges, to be honest. But in this particular one, Thor begins drinking. And he says, like, no man can outdrink me. You know, I'm the fiercest god in the entire, in all of existence, and no man can outdrink me. So he's drinking, and he's drinking, and he's drinking. And he's like, oh, what the hell? The fog's not going down. Struggling, are we, Thor? And he goes, no. Let me continue. So he's drinking, and he's drinking, and he's drinking. And the level of mead is still not going down. And he's like, what the hell is this? But what he doesn't realize is that the bottom of the horn is actually been put into the Lake of Nines. So instead of drinking a horn of mead, he's actually been tricked into drinking an entire lake. So he's sort of, he's been tricked again. Because that's the thing with Thor is, it is sort of depicted as being sort of childlike in a way. You know, he has temper tantrums. So sometimes, you know, people get the better of him. But when we're saying that, there is quite a masculine prevalence in this faith. There is, I admit that. But, you know, we respect, you know, the aspects of the feminine as well. Obviously, I have a patron goddess in Freya, but really, I don't think your faith should really be limited to just to gender, you know. As I say, we are inclusive and we accept anybody of any background, any orientation.
It's more energies. I work with energies. That's what I was getting at. It was more like energies and more masculine energy. And there's a lot of gods in there, where there's, I mean, there's a lot of gods in Wicca as well, but I don't really tend to work with them that much. There's only a few alike.
Well, there's the Horned One. The mother. That's what I mean. It's we've got an entire like pantheon of, I think, probably equal amounts of gods and goddesses. So there is quite a healthy balance. It's really a focus on what attracts you personally. Obviously, I've worked with the goddess Freya quite a lot, and she's sort of like probably the feminine balance in my life, you know, alongside all the big burly masculine gods. From a lot of stuff we've discussed here today, there's so many misconceptions everywhere, and a lot of people are not aware of them. And it's only through learning, and I pride myself on reading a lot. As I mentioned, I've got two whole bookcases absolutely full of books because I love to learn. I love to expand my mind, and you don't know until you actually, you know, read up properly, like the thing with the Vikings and in the horns.
Yeah. I think that's a whole entire other podcast episode, is like perceived misconnotations and stuff. I think that'd be really cool.
I'd love to be a guest again, but I'd definitely have to make sure I'm set up properly next time. Making a lot of rookie mistakes on this podcast.
The god I know, do you know, from The Mask from the 90s with Jim Carrey.
That was based on Loki.
Yeah, that's one of my favourite ever films, and that god is right with Steve, isn't he?
Is kind of known as sort of like the bastard god in in like the Norse mythos. He's single-handedly contributed to not only the reign of the gods, but also the downfall as well. Because he is incredibly mischievous. There's a famous tale where there's a god known as Balder. Is the son of Odin, is the god of light, is like radiance, benevolence, is known for his beauty, and is the one god that everybody respected and honored just because, you know, he was just so pure. And Loki did not give a shit. He did not care. And he actually tricked a blind man into killing him with an arrow using his one and only weakness. Because he was like so pure and benevolent, his mother Freya actually created this obsession to keep him safe, to the point where she actually placed a magic ritual onto him where he was protected by every single thing in the universe from dying, except she missed one thing, and that turned out to be his kryptonite, and it was mistletoe. He was safe from all illnesses, all injuries, but the one thing that she missed was mistletoe, and the god Loki cottoned onto that. And he, the blind god Hodir, we kind of whispered into his ear, told him a bunch of gibberish, but he actually tricked him into using a mistletoe braided arrow, which he fired into Loki, which ultimately killed him. And he just did that just because he was the god of mischief. Yeah, Balder ended up going to the Norse realm of Hel, Helheim. They have 9 worlds in the Norse mythology. And he cast down to Hel, and Odin was furious. So he punished him by bound him to a rock, and he had a serpent like spit venom to him constantly, tortured him until he died. Because he was that furious with childish pranks, but he didn't really realize the consequences. It's almost like he's like a depiction of a child. They're so carefree and mischievous, but they don't realize what they're actually doing until it's too late.
Smoking! Somebody stop me!
P-A-R-T. Why?
Because I got us!
Because it started off as a comic book, with The Mask, but that's where its origins come from. And there's so many films and like TV shows, and they've got so much of its like ideas from Norse mythology, even Christianity as a whole. I don't say borrowed, but kind of took a lot of our ideas, our religious holidays, And it was such a great source of inspiration. There's so many great writers and directors. Another example is, if anybody out there's a big fan of Lord of the Rings, like I am, in the Hobbit trilogy, there's the dragon Smaug. He hoards all the gold in, you know, the Dwarven Keep, you know, the mountain. And that is actually taken from another tale in Norse mythology, where there was a man by the name of Fafnir, a dwarf by the name of Fafnir, and he developed an obsession with gold. And so much so that he took over his entire life, and he was punished for it, and he was actually transformed into a dragon, and he was bound to living foreverly just in keep of this gold. That became his entire life until he was killed by the warrior Sigrun one day. But it tells the story of how an obsession can lead to a person's downfall, person's destruction. He became so intoxicated by greed, by avarice, his lust for gold, and it eventually cost him everything, mm-hmm. to the point where that's all he had left was his obsession. And it speaks like so many truths to like people today, anybody going through addiction, anybody going through obsession. And it's crazy how this is just a tale, but it speaks so much truth in the real world today. But that's just another example of how influential Norse Anglo-Saxon mythology is, because it's inspired so much and is the backbone, the basis of my own faith, of heathenry and Germanic paganism. And there's we kind of joke, say it's the religion with homework. Because a lot of time, you know, I'm forever reading and reading. And honestly, I come back to things like, oh, I forgot all about that. But there's just so much to read about and uncover. And it's such a fascinating trove of like knowledge. And there's so much inspiration as well. As I say, I use it in my own life when I'm creating the mead. You know, I get so many ideas and I think about what I've read and, you know, how can I put that in something creative, like an art project? And like my friend does it, you know, when he's carving his wood idols. My friend Luke is exceptionally gifted when it comes to like woodwork. He's got his own business called Deadwood Creations. He can do anything to order. He has a lot of projects. You basically tell him what you want and he can carve it out of wood. You know, he's got a little sort of like a fabrication set up in his garage. He'll whittle the wood himself and he'll, you know, finish it up with like Dremel tools and things. But he can, any idea you can put to paper, he can create. And a lot of the wooden items are on my altar of what he's made. I honestly believe, guys, he's just got such a connection, you know, to like the old ways, the old way of life, the spiritual side, his connection to the ancestors, where it actually made me think the other day when a lot of people in the modern world have forgotten how to do things, create things. Like, technology is just so rampant these days. And I'm sort of against the advancement of technology because people are forgetting to do things. People are becoming lazy and complacent. And it speaks a lot of truths where we live in a world today where technology, AI, can do things for you. The ChatGPT app, you can ask that to write a book for you. And all you have to do is change the syntax and you can publish a book online. I believe somebody's done it on Amazon. The guy's making a killing making children's books that he's not even written himself. We've got musicians who are using auto-tune and editing the voices when years ago, you know, people had to rely on their own talent, their own creativity. But it just shows, you know, the direction the world's going. And our faith kind of encourages you to step away from that, to transport your mind back to an older time where people actually went out there and did things themselves. They learn and they develop skills. You know, people, hunters and fishermen, and people sculpted, and people just did all these amazing things. But then just people can't just do it these days. It's kind of sad in a way to see it, you know, because I'm a huge fan of history. I love like the Renaissance era. You had these incredible like polymaths such as Leonardo da Vinci. And you can see that the guy excelled at so many things, painting, astrology, the guy created a concept for the first ever working helicopter. He was such a brilliant mind. But people back then, they were more in tune with the spiritual, the natural world. These days, I think it's kind of lost. People have forgotten that connection. It's kind of sad to see in a way. I encourage anybody to find themselves, you know, to find those connections. Like when I meet up with a group of fellow heathens, when we're passing the ceremonial horn around during a blot, it's a great example of connectivity. It's not just a group of people, it's a brotherhood. When I feel the connection, passing the horn around, it's kind of ironic in a way because our advanced technology is these days. People have got more opportunity to be connected in terms of technology, social media. But ironically, we're actually more disconnected than we ever have been. Got all this advancement and all this accessibility, but it's actually doing the opposite effect. It's almost like we're devolving in a way. I like to go back to a time where, you know, things were different. Just pondering and pontificating on life and the universe.
The universe and everything.
Honestly, just deconstruct everything. Crack open the egg and see what you find.
You could probably come back on and talk to us about all the gods and goddesses and tell us stories. That'd be so good.
Yeah, I'd love that. Touched up on a little bit of some in this episode. I've told a few tales, the tale of Utgarda Loki and the inspiration, you know, behind Loki, you know, and the mask. I've got so much more I could share.
You know, my bearded dragon Dave, tedious link, but when I got him, he was called Smog. I changed his name to Dave. Looks like a Dave. Thank you very much for this amazing insight into your spiritual life. It's brilliant to hear you talk about it.
I remember when I first mentioned it to you, you were like, well, how's that? You know, I've never been to Stonehenge.
Me neither.
We should go.
We should totally go, yeah.
It's on a solstice, you know.
Just want to say, every day is Tuesday, witches!
Every day is Tuesday, witches. Is that the name of the episode? Friend with mead is a friend indeed.
Oh yeah, that's good. Maybe that could be it. So how good was that? I hope you enjoyed it. He's going to have to come on a few times because I think he's just packed to the brim with awesome education and passion. And I've got a bit of news. I recorded this with you quite a while back, as I do. Recently, he sent me a message updating me on the Iron Ravens, in which Chu has been accepted into the Iron Ravens group and is on the council and is solely responsible for creating events and rituals and making decisions. And I am just so chuffed for him that he's gone in there. Bless him, he's such a good egg. You have been listening to the Bellwitch podcast, made with love and magic by me, Swales, the friendly green witch. If you enjoy what I'm creating, please let me know, either by rating me, reviewing me, messaging me. I love messages. I love comments on Instagram, the Bellwitch podcast, with underscores between each word. I'm always looking for guests. I'm always looking to do trailer swaps. If you've got a witchy, spiritual podcast about anything pagan related, do sign to my DMs and let's share the knowledge. Let's share the audience. I'd love to support you in your new adventures or your ongoing adventures. If you've been doing it for ages and you're a dab hand at it, it'd be awesome to connect. So that's it from me. Thank you for listening and stay magical, witches. Thank you.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's mind.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.